Economics is the study of human choice in the world we live. Faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. By investigating faith in economics, we can learn how they lead to human flourishing. This is the Faith in Economics Podcast, a presentation of the Gortney Institute at Ottawa University.
Welcome to our show today. I am Kevin Ugarteche, producer and graduate assistant for the Gortney Institute. With us today, Dr. Ross McCullough, the founder of the Gortney Institute and Wayne Engel Chair of Economics, Dr. Justin Clark, the Menard Family Professor of Philosophy and Ethics, finally, Dr. Peter Jacobson, the Gortney Professor of Economic Education and Research.
All right, so I'm a meat lover. I don't know about you. I had some wonderful slices of meat in Las Vegas at a conference we were just recently at, and Justin happened to come across something on X that is looking at regulations in various ways on meat processing and maybe some other areas. So, Justin, you want to lead us through this?
Yeah, so I think this ties back. If you're a listener of this podcast, you might remember that when we talked about the potential merger between Albertsons and Dillon's, one of my fears was that this kind of just increases the federal government's control over our food supply, which I'm paranoid about. And, you know, there's the old Jewish proverb, which I love, which says, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they aren't out to get you. And I am paranoid, but that also doesn't mean that they aren't out to control our food supply. And one of the things that has been in the news for the past couple of years is the degree to which things like avian flu gets in into chickens, and they've been trying to implement mRNA COVID vaccines to give to beef cattle. I mean, a lot of times when you just buy like ribeye at the store or whatever, you don't know this. And so even if you're very diligent about what you put into your body, you might not be so aware of what is going into the bodies of the bodies of the things that you're eating, right? And I think sometimes when I express this worry to people, they say things like, this is crazy. They're not, you know, the farmers aren't going to do this or that. The government's not going to force farmers to do this or that. But there's this great tweet that was put up by Brianna Sogdahl where the question is, can the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, mandate testing, surveillance, or culling for animal diseases? And note also that all of the big epidemics that we've had recently, those have all been at least classified as animal diseases in the sense that they appeared in humans after being transferred from animals.
And is she a researcher or high level
independent researcher?
Okay. Okay.
I mean,
just curious.
In the sense, we'll put this tweet in the notes too. The good thing about this tweet is that it has receipts. So for every claim that's made, there's a Federal Register showing the law that says what's the case here.
Take,
for example, mandatory testing of livestock. And the short answer, she says, is yes, the USDA has authority to and has implemented mandatory disease testing and reporting in livestock. There's a list of monitored diseases, and a veterinarian suspect that an animal is ill with a certain disease, such as avian flu, it's mandatory that they immediately report it to the APHIS and send samples for testing. And then the note on this that I think is interesting is that this policy was actually not mandatory. It was voluntary until 2020. And I think that this is something that we're going to see a lot of going forward is this kind of incremental ratchet by which the federal government slowly proposes things. And when they are proposed, they are proposed as, look, we'll just set the system in place. It would be nice for us to have this kind of system. We're not going to force you to do it, right? it's just there if you want to use it. And then after a couple of years, the argument goes, we have this system in place. You know, we want people to use it. It's almost unfair if we don't make everybody use it. Right. And so there's this kind of like two-step process by which something gets proposed that you don't have to comply with. And the argument is, look, why are you complaining about this? It's not even mandatory. And then once they have it in place, they go, well, we have the system, so we're going to use it. I mean, we kind of hold off on that tactic for a second, because I think it gets used all over the place.
Right.
But what I think we see if we go through this, so it's mandatory testing, then surveillance and tracking. The USDA currently has the authority to and has implemented RFID ear tags for early detection and response to domestic, emerging, and foreign animal diseases.
Justin, what's that mean? What's an RFID tag? I don't know what that means.
RFID is radio frequency ID. So it's like this the tags that also detect when you're shoplifting. So every time you've been arrested, Peter, that's how they've gotten you. And so I'm not surprised that you don't know what they are.
So how does that relate to them having diseases though? Because I can't imagine that it's like scanning their blood or something like that. I'm confused.
No, but it's a unique identifier for each piece of for each cattle, right?
Okay.
So otherwise, you know, I know cattle aren't exactly fungible, but it might be difficult to tell between if you have a herd of 100,000
Okay.
cattle,
So
which one.
when you get the blood tested, you can't just say,
And
no,
then they
that
just
one ran away months
they
ago.
track it. I think they track it
Sure.
back to that herd. They know the animals that were in that herd, and then they kill all of them and not allow their meat on the market. I think it's
Well,
something
that's
along those
tracking.
lines.
The next one is culling, right?
Okay.
So culling is what Russ just described, which is when you think you have an outbreak, and you can locate it to a specific herd or a specific cow. You might have to kill that particular cow or kill the herd that that cow was in. So that's culling. And right now it's a gray area on whether culling can be made mandatory or not. But if my thesis is correct, anything that is a gray area now will definitely be black and white later, and it's not going to go in the direction of the discretion of the individual farmer. It's going to
Right.
go into a mandated rule by the government. So what all this kind of sets in motion is, and you can kind of see how these steps depend on each other. There's the testing, and then the tracking, and then the culling. And so you need mandatory testing to make tracking work to enable mandatory culling, right? So if you're not testing them, then it doesn't make sense to track them. And there's no point in tracking them unless you can cull them, and you can't cull them unless you can track them, right? So, but with what all these things have, when you put these all together, it gives the federal government an unbelievable amount of control over what kind of things you're able to eat if these rules apply to everybody or even only to large-scale farmers, and those are the only ones who can get their meat into a grocery store. So not only could the federal government specify that the only meat you can get is meat that has these kinds of additives or vaccines or whatever added to it, but the federal government could also very easily initiate some kind of supply shock to drive the price of these things up by either identifying or misidentifying some kind of animal disease that they claim is present at any given time.
And all of this initiative is based on pure fear. Do we have some empirical evidence of the cost of these diseases killing people and causing mass destruction to our food supply or
I think
whatever?
we have a bunch of evidence of animal diseases disrupting the food supply, right? We have a bunch of examples of human diseases disrupting the human economy, right? The question is, at what level should discretion and control be administered? And what's really disturbing to me is that this is driving control up a bunch of levels. The control is ascending, and it's ascending to the same people who we hear saying things like, everybody needs to eat less meat. We need to do whatever we can to make sure people eat less meat. We're willing to, infect ticks with this special kind of Lyme disease that gives people a meat allergy because we think that would be great, which is one of the things that the guy, at the WEF forum said. Because you can't actually get a meat allergy from some tick-borne illness. And he said, look, we don't have to make meat illegal. We can just make people allergic to it. Right? And you also don't have to make meat illegal if you can make it, you can make the price of a choice ribeye steak the same price as a current, A5 Wagyu beef or whatever.
Yeah. You mean my $27 double cheeseburger in Vegas that I bought on Monday? And I am not kidding. It was pretty normal It was good, but it was $27 for a burger, fries, no drink. Burger, fries, $27. No tip.
Well,
Bought
you
it at a
deserve
temp.
it because there's an In-N-Out in Vegas, and I know that you didn't go there because you paid $27 for that.
We'll see. I'd like I should have went there, and I did see the signage up for that. I needed to snap a photo of its board to see if pricing. So, well, so I the other thing I see with this is the public choice issues of the testing company now has an interest in seeing the testing accelerate. The RFID tracking company now has an interest in pushing this legislation through. And so there's these other people behind the scenes that would like to see this thing not sitting dormant, like you were saying, in the very first stage of, well, we just got the system set up and here's how it works. And now all of a sudden we have these constituents that would want to see it go through. A little profitable opportunity for them.
Yeah, and look, we just went through a pandemic, and that is exactly what these people will say, right? They'll say, we just went through a pandemic. We need to make sure we have a system set up for these animals. But the counter argument to that is we just went through a pandemic, and the same people who are putting forward these ideas are the same people who bungled the pandemic response so badly. They so wildly overestimated the cost, like for children. And the risks for COVID, and they so wildly underestimated the costs in terms of like loss of learning and things like that. Even like if you look at the testing, you had the FDA approving tests for COVID that couldn't distinguish between influenza and COVID, right? Which is why they had to, at the end of 2022, I think, eliminate some version of the PCR test that they were using. So for a process like this to work, everybody has to be a moral saint, and all the technology has to work perfectly. And we have an abundance of evidence that those things are emphatically not true of the people who are proposing this. So this is just like huge red flags to me.
And I'd also say you kind of touched on this. It's probably not obvious that the deeper this tracking and level of the sophistication goes, that it'll decrease the spread. That they're probably thinking in their minds like, oh, it's 100% solid science that if we catch it earlier, we will have X benefit, and that's been shown to not be true in a number of ways with government testing and regulation and monitoring, whether you're in the banking sector, whether you're in the airplane doors falling off stuff. Time and time again, the additional monitoring testing doesn't seem to work as well as they think it's going to. All right, well, this looks like a good spot for our break. And so when we come back, we'll explore this issue a little bit more with some issues related to where this goes in the future and what the future holds. We'll be back in just a bit.
Ottawa University has an exciting new major, PPE, which stands for Philosophy, Politics, and Economics. Each of these fields is interesting in their own right, but they intersect in ways that are important to understand, both individually and for your community. If you find philosophy fascinating but want to make sure that your study of the subject is practical, if you enjoy economic analysis but want to see how economic laws interact with moral principles, if you are interested in politics but want to explore how economic and ethical realities constrain our political choices, you should consider the PPE program at Ottawa University.
This spring, Ottawa University is organizing a PPE League competition for politics, philosophy, and economics. Students in this competition will compete leveraging the ideas of philosophy, politics, and economics in various events. If you're a professor or an advisor of college students and you're interested in your school competing in PPE League this spring, contact Peter, Justin, or Russ today.
By 2030, the Gortney Institute will be known for its alumni, supporters, and participants who incorporate economic understanding with their faith in their careers, vocations, communities, and personal lives. We have some great programming going on for high school students. We have an online microeconomics class. Yes, you can earn college credit for $200 by taking an online class. It's affordable, flexible, layered with support. Our new online micro is optimized for you. If you'd like to consider some events for your high school students or that class, please contact Justin, Peter, or Russ today.
All right, so we're back, and Peter's brain was overheating, so he didn't get a chance to give us all his wisdom and thoughts on this topic, so we're going to let him start off the second half. What do you got, Peter?
Yeah, so I think one of the things to notice about this is that it just creates bad incentives apart from, like Justin said, for this to work, everybody has to be like angelic. I think even if everyone was angelic in our country, for example, this would still create weird incentives. And so I see this as like a national security threat to a certain extent. Who benefits, or another way of putting this is like, how would you, without firing a shot, ruin a country? One of the quickest ways I can think of is to make food unaffordable, right? And so by like generating this system where we are more prone to engage in like type one errors, I think there's type one and type two errors. Type one error basically deals with like false positives, making an action that's incorrect, right? That's a type one error. And so like in our current system, maybe we have type two errors. A type two error is like when you don't act and that causes a problem. And so like if we don't notice that a cow is sick and that cow's meat goes to a grocery store, a bunch of people might get sick. And so by not doing anything about it, we've made a mistake. That's a type two error. But what I see is like, in order to correct for this, it seems like we're going to generate maybe all these type one errors where like we cull an entire herd because like there was one sick cow and now a bunch of like meat that was otherwise good is going to be gone, right? Or the, you know, national security threat side of things is, if I am a country that has animus towards the United States, what I start doing is going and targeting like these large companies that have really frequent testing. And I start trying to infect like one or two cows in that herd, get the whole herd to die or be cold or whatever, and like affect food prices, right? Because that's one of the greatest ways to insert instability into a country is to make it expensive for regular people to get access to food. So I see this being like ripe for all sorts of problems. And this doesn't even get into the fact that Justin mentioned that the reason that this can happen or is feasible is because, well, and I don't think you said this word for word, but like it's true that the reason that this is even feasible for us is because we have such centralization in our agriculture industry now, right? Like almost every chicken that you buy at one point touches Tyson. And this is not like a natural thing that's occurred. This is the result of regulations like this that make it very expensive to be a small independent farmer and sell your food to a grocery store or whatever, right? And so now we're at this place where we have just a few mechanized farming industry stooges who benefit from more regulations because it's very hard to comply with regulations if you're a small farmer. And so they have an incentive to support those regulations, even though otherwise they would be against them if it weren't for the non-competitive aspects, because it's going to be expensive for them to deal with. They're going to be supportive of these policies. That's going to cause further problems of competition. And by the way, what is worse for agricultural diseases than having a few very large mega farms, right? Like if all the chickens are running through the same blender in the Tyson plants, then you're very easily going to have a lot of infected chickens. And so what would be better for our society is if we got rid of all these regulations that have hyper-centralized our agricultural industry to where like, yeah, now if one chicken is sick, they are all going to get sick because they're all shoved in like one little box, right? Just a few of my thoughts. But so I want to add, not that I disagree with Justin, I think this is ripe for domestic abuse as well. But I think there are some foreign abuse issues, and there's just some incentive misalignments, some systematic tendencies that are going to be a result of this, even if people aren't consciously trying to cause problems, right? It's not like Tyson is consciously trying to skyrocket food prices through this necessarily. It's just that they don't want the competition, right? And they know that the regulation helps them get rid of their competition. So yeah, there's just all sorts of secondary effects generated by this sort of thing.
There's a great documentary-ish from the guy who ate McDonald's for 30 days and kind of got sick off of it. All he ate was McDonald's.
Super Size Me,
yeah. He made a second video and tried to open up a chicken company. And he really exposed all the regulations and how difficult it was to compete with big chicken, basically. It's a pretty good eye-opener to that. Maybe we'll try to link that in the show notes, too. But that's a good one for people to really see the level of barriers that it creates for just the little guy trying to, you know, produce some chickens. Because the regulations were so stringent, it didn't even make sense to even, you know, have a small chicken farm.
So I don't know the name of that second documentary, but I know his name is Morgan Spurlock. So okay. If people are looking for it. To build on what Peter said, so Peter said that, you know, there's also these foreign adversarial opportunities, and it sets up incentives for that. We can also think about the way the incentive is set up if you are a regulator, and this is usually to err on the side of safety, yep. Right? And this actually creates an incentive on the part of a farmer to not exercise their own judgment in the best way. And to illustrate this, I'll use an example that I think both Peter and Russ have heard before, but you know, I grew up in California, and California has really, really strict environmental protection rules around endangered species. Mm-hmm. In particular, if you find an endangered species on your property, it's that piece of your land, and that, you know, they draw a radius around where you found it. It becomes pretty much unusable to you, and you now have to not use it, and you're responsible for protecting it. And so the rule, I grew up around a lot of ranchers, and I don't want to implicate any of them, that the rule for if you find an endangered species on your property in California, the rancher's rule that they tell each other are the three S's, and it's shoot, shovel, and shut up about it. meaning that if you find an endangered species, since if you report it, that your land will essentially be taken away from you, the incentive it creates is for you to actually just kill it and pretend that it didn't exist there at all. And you can see something like that being the case here, where if the rules for culling were such that if any cattle in your herd were discovered to have some kind of disease, you were required to cull the entire herd. If you're a farmer and, you know, you might actually have the incentive if you're, you know, going off your reputation, your incentive absent this policy might be something like, well, I need to check my cows and I'm going to kill all the ones that look like they might be infected or that I know shared a really close space to this cow that was infected. But you're relying on your judgment there as a farmer. But once this rule comes down, and the rule will err on the side of being strict, if that rule says you have to kill your whole herd, well, that actually creates an incentive to you now to kind of maybe fudge a test or lie about the results that you're getting, essentially the analog of the shooting and shut up about it.
Well, there's 2 points now brought up. I wanted to bring up Milton Friedman because his name was brought up as usual at the conference we were just at. But yeah, he was one of the early people to point out the incentives of like the FDA and other places to make things overly safe, overly in the sense of not passing a cost benefit analysis and kind of favoring job security and doing more than what's needed. But also the lack of people being free to choose. So Milton's prescription for issues like this would be, let's not put burdensome regulation on this, but rather let's put the data out there. Okay, so there's been a strand of this virus or something that's going through the meat in Wyoming. And people just choose whether they're going to maybe give up meat for a month or take the risk themselves, knowing maybe it's not life-threatening, maybe it's just you're going to get sick for a stomach illness or something, and let people be free to choose to take on the risk to live their life. And so, you know, that might not be a perfect way to apply it, but that in general was the prescription of we all take risk every day, deciding on whether to walk across the street at the crosswalk or to, you know, jump across. And so somehow when we come to this, we're over protecting and we're taking away people's freedoms that way. And the answer is just to make sure information's out there.
Yeah. I mean, my general thought on this is like, this is the issue with a government organization, right? Ultimately, is that a for-profit organization, again, to kind of relate back to what I was saying a second ago, there are costs and benefits associated with being conservative with respect to animal disease, right? The benefit is if you're very conservative about your herd, you know, being sick and things like that, then you're going to have a lot less people infected by diseases from eating your meat. The cost is that there's going to be less meat and it's going to be more expensive if you're overly conservative, right? And so if you cull an entire herd and really not many of them were sick, Maybe you could have figured out the ones that weren't sick, but you're required to cull them all. You're going to drive the price up. And by the way, it hurts people either way. There's sort of like a sensitivity in these issues to focus on like the negligence aspect of like, well, you know, this cow was sick. You gave me a sick cow's meat. But it also hurts people in a much less visible way if your actions lead to higher prices for people who like are on the margin of being able to afford groceries, for example. And so there's errors either way. The government solution to this is, as Justin pointed out and Russ pointed out, to be over-conservative because it looks a lot worse. It's a lot more visible if the FDA or whoever's in charge of this accidentally allow some mad cow disease beef to go through. That looks really, really bad. If instead all of a sudden prices of cows are like or meat is like 50 cents more a pound on aggregate, that could be a really huge effect. But you know, most people aren't going to be able to disentangle what caused that price hike, right? Because prices of things just move around. And so it's very visible to make this mistake of allowing the disease beef to go through. It's very hard to see the price problem. Now, private companies are good because they weigh these things against each other, right? If you have prices go up because you culled part of your herd, you're losing money. On the flip side, if you give someone diseased beef, that word gets out, your reputation gets worse, and you lose money that way. And so at least you have to weigh different consumer evaluations in the form of profit and loss, basically, in order to make the decision. With government, there's no rational metric by which you make that decision, right? You could arbitrarily create a metric, which is what happens, but it's not tracking consumer valuations or anything like that. It's just like tracking whatever the bureaucratic organization thought was the best rule of thumb, which just doesn't have any clear relationship to what the real rule of thumb should be. So this is like the really deep problem with this sort of thing is like private companies already have to weigh these incentives. And when we err on one side or another side, people just don't see the downside of doing
that.
Yeah,
and I kind of want to be clear. I guess I'm okay. You know, I think some people listen to this podcast and they think, oh, you guys just want to get rid of all laws, rules, regulations. And maybe in some cases we do. But
yes,
this is one particular one where I want to toe the line, at least for myself, and I'll see what you guys say, of just like, let's just stop it here. Like, let's not go this new step that Justin brought up with this system. And then it, you know, slowly bleeds. Like, let's just stop where we are. Like, I think if we could get people, you know, the average Joe to say, you're right, you know, there is, I feel pretty well protected with my food supply, and let's just kind of stop the progression that we're on of where the laws just keep piling up and higher and higher and higher, and just kind of draw a line. Maybe that's the pragmatist in me just thinking, let's just stop here.
Is that Buckley, Justin?
Standing athwart history, yelling stop.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that the Buckley line? Yeah. So like that's the old William F. Buckley line of the job of a conservative is to stand athwart history, the line of history, whatever, yelling stop. That sounds really nice. Let's look at the year Buckley said that quote. And then let's look at today and see if we stop. And the answer is no.
The answer is no.
If someone says we want to move forward at 100 miles an hour and you say we want to stop, a compromise will be found in the middle at like 50 miles an hour. Right. Yeah. So there's almost like a necessity at which I think the answer to this, or at least part of the answer to this, as usual, I'm going to provide the non-politics solution because I don't know the politics solution. But one thing that I see, and I guess there's politics involved, but one thing that I see developing, at least in Ottawa, which is really cool, is that people are a lot more interested in like having their own animals. Mm-hmm. And that includes people in town. There's been a lot of like negotiating at city council meetings and stuff. So that's how it's a little bit political about being allowed to have chickens in town, for example. And, you know, my neighbor has a chicken, and I think it's probably not a legal chicken for the record, but I'm not sure. And I would never say anything to anyone about it because I want him to be able to have the chicken, right?
You might be able to trade that chicken for something later, right? Some local trades here. I'll give you half of my side of beef for a future supply of 20 chickens.
I don't even know if I'm going to take his chickens, but I just like the cultural move towards people feeling like they should have some sort of hand in their own food. Or like hunting is similar to this, right? Is
sure.
You know, the FDA is not tracking down all the deer in the forest or anything like that. So or all the roadkill that I pick up on my truck. So yeah, that's the sort of thing that I think is valuable. There's probably other things, obviously, like I hope this thing is stopped. I don't have a whole lot of faith that it will be, but Justin, I don't know. Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah. So the other quote I like that is like the Buckley quote, I know Peter, I know you this one. I know you know this one too, which is the Michael Malice quote that a conservative is a progressive driving the speed limit.
Yeah.
Right. right. Which, look, Russ, you said you would like to stop here. And I think my argument for why that won't work is that two-step process that I brought up at the very beginning.
Yeah, it's a technique.
Which, yeah, the technique is we'll get you to agree to this thing, which doesn't have any costs, right? Because it's voluntary. And I think that the pragmatist in everybody says, well, let's agree to that, right? And then once we get everybody to agree to that, Russ, you don't have to agree with this step to take to go a little further, but everybody else is going to, and then you're going to get dragged along. And so I think the only way to fight this stuff is to fight it at step one. And then, you know, you get accused of making a slippery slope argument. People will go, that's just a slippery slope argument. You can point out like, yeah, the history of humanity is a history of groups of people falling down slippery slopes together. Slippery slope isn't always a fallacy. I don't think it's a fallacy that often, actually. Look, I agree with you that it would be better to stop here than go any further. I just don't think practically we can stop here. I think once you make it to here, the government already has all the inertia they need to get that ratchet to snap one snap further. And so, you know, one of my like pet peeves, we had like, at our university, we had a syllabus policy, right? Which was you have to include all these things on the syllabus, but faculty get to make their own syllabus. So the policy really didn't have any teeth, right? And then we instituted we got a software where now faculty have to go through this software to make their own syllabi. And now all of a sudden, all that stuff that, you know, didn't really have teeth that you wouldn't get punished for not including it, you can't remove it. And if you try to complain now about it, they'll say, well, this has been policy for 5 years. Why didn't you complain about it when we said you had to include it on your syllabus?
Your syllabus didn't used to have this information? Oh, it should
have. Yeah. Oh my gosh, you've been a scofflaw for the past 5 years.
Yeah.
And so, oh, man. Yeah, I just think that when you everywhere you look, you can kind of see this this two-step policy being implemented, and you can see it being implemented because it works.
Yeah. Well, and I guess to be clear, when I said we should stop here, I meant not even have the form that we most people would agree to. So I was trying to go before that step even. But yes, I get what you're saying. And that one is a hard one politically to not get people to agree to, because it does sound harmless, but that's the whole technique. Yeah, get the ball rolling, get a little momentum.
Yeah. There's like that quote about plant, like the best day to plant a tree is today or yesterday, but the second best time is today. And I think about that with regard, like the best policy to oppose is the one that's already implemented, but you know, the second best one is the one that they're proposing right now.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we all have a central agreement on this, that like the system is too centralized right now, that like we have created too many rules and regulations, which have led us into this regulatory spiral, kind of like I won't get into it too much, but Mises had this great argument about that the middle of the road policy leads to socialism. And his claim was, if you want to successfully institute a control on prices, you're going to have to make an increasing number of interventions to sustain that policy, because it's going to, you know, if you put a price control on milk to make the price of milk really low, then farmers are going to start to go out of business. So then you have to put a new policy in place that taxes people, so that way it can, you know, keep the farmers in business and so on. I think this is where we're at now, is that we have so many, we have such a large regulatory labyrinth that you can find at any time any number of justifications for a new regulation, because you've created all these problems with the old ones.
I thought one of your good points earlier, I think it was Justin, with the weakness as we get more centralized, I just started thinking like China or something, right? So if they start to be able to infiltrate something of a trigger, you know, that we've already seen it happen with supply chain, COVID, some other things, but the more we have these systems centralized, it really gives a point of weakness from a national defense perspective as well.
I'm glad you thought that was my idea, but actually that was Peter's.
Was it Peter? Okay.
Yeah.
I forgot I had that.
I was going to say, I kind of thought it was, but that's okay. Yeah. I think that point of weakness and does expose us, similar to all these other supply chain and internet weakness and other things. So All right. Well, that looks like a good spot to wrap. Any other last words? All right. Well, this has been a production of the Gortney Institute here at Ottawa University. I'd like to thank you all for listening. 5-star rating helps people find us. Otherwise, pass this along to your friends and family by whatever means you choose. Other than that, be fruitful and multiply. Thanks.